Disc 6.
The Thumb Mark of St. Peter. "And now, Aunt Jane, it's up to you," said Raymond West, who was host that evening to a group of friends. There was Joyce Lompierre, the artist, with her close-cropped black hair and queer hazel-green eyes, and Sir Henry Clithering, ex-commissioner of Scotland Yard. There was Dr. Pender, the elderly clergyman of the parish, and Mr. Petherick, the solicitor, a dried-up little man with eyeglasses which he looked over and not through. And, of course, there was his Aunt Jane. Raymond looked across the hearth to where she sat erect in the big grandfather chair. Miss Marple wore a black brocade dress, very much pinched in round the waist. Her faded blue eyes, benignant and kindly, looked up at the mention of her name. "Yes, Aunt Jane, we're expecting something really spicy," chimed in Joyce Lompierre. "Now you're laughing at me, my dear," said Miss Marple placidly. "You think that because I've lived in this out-of-the-way spot all my life, I am not likely to have had any very interesting experiences." "God forbid that I should ever regard village life as peaceful and uneventful," said Raymond with fervour. "Not after the horrible revelations we've heard from you. The cosmopolitan world seems a mild and peaceful place compared with St. Mary Mead." "Well, my dear," said Miss Marple, "human nature is much the same everywhere, and of course one has opportunities of observing it at closer quarters in a village." "You really are unique, Aunt Jane," cried Joyce. "I hope you don't mind me calling you Aunt Jane," she added. "I don't know why I do it." "Don't you, my dear?" said Miss Marple. She looked up for a moment or two with something quizzical in her glance, which made the blood flame to the girl's cheeks. Raymond West fidgeted and cleared his throat in a somewhat embarrassed manner. Miss Marple looked at them both and smiled again, and bent her attention once more to her knitting. "It is true, of course, that I've lived what is called a very uneventful life, but I've had a lot of experiences in solving different little problems that have arisen. Some of them have been really quite ingenious, but it would be no good telling them to you because they are about such unimportant things that you would not be interested. Just things like, who cut the meshes of Mrs. Jones' string bag, and why Mrs. Sims only wore her new fur coat once. Very interesting things, really, to any student of human nature. No, the only experience that I can remember that would be of interest to you is the one about my poor niece Mabel's husband. It's about 10 or 15 years ago now, and happily it's all over and done with, and everyone has forgotten about it. People's memories are very short. A lucky thing, I will think." Miss Marple paused and murmured to herself, "I must just count this row. The decreasing is a little awkward. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then 3 pearl. Yes, that's right. Now, what was I saying? Oh, yes, about poor Mabel. Mabel was my niece, a nice girl, really, a very nice girl, but just a trifle what one might call silly. Rather fond of being melodramatic and of saying a great deal more than she meant whenever she was upset. She married a Mr. Denman when she was 22, and I'm afraid it was not a very happy marriage. I'd hoped very much that the attachment would not come to anything, for Mr. Denman was a man of very violent temper, not the kind of man who would be patient with Mabel's foibles. I also learnt that there was insanity in his family. However, girls are just as obstinate then as they are now, and as they always will be. And Mabel married him. I didn't see very much of her after her marriage. She came to stay with me once or twice, and they asked me there several times, but as a matter of fact I'm not very fond of staying in other people's houses, and I always managed to make some excuse. They'd been married 10 years when Mr. Denman died suddenly. There were no children, and he left all his money to Mabel. I wrote, of course, and offered to come to Mabel if she wanted me, but she wrote back a very sensible letter, and I gathered that she was not altogether overwhelmed by grief. I thought that was only natural, because I knew they'd not be getting on well together for some time. It was not until about 3 months afterwards that I got a most hysterical letter from Mabel, begging me to come to her, and saying that things were going from bad to worse, and she couldn't stand it much longer. "'So, of course,' continued Miss Marple, "'I put Clara on board wages "'and sent the plate and the King Charles tanker to the bank, "'and I went off at once. "'I found Mabel in a very nervous state. "'The house Myrtle Dean was a fairly large one, "'very comfortably furnished. "'There was a cook and a house parlour-maid, "'as well as a nurse attendant "'to look after old Mr. Denman, "'Mabel's husband's father, "'who was what is called not quite right in the head.' Quite peaceful and well-behaved, but distinctly odd at times. As I say, there was insanity in the family. I was really shocked to see the change in Mabel. She was a mass of nerves, twitching all over, and yet I had the greatest difficulty in making her tell me what the trouble was. I got at it, as one always does get at these things, indirectly. I asked her about some friends of hers she was always mentioning in her letters, the Gallaghers. She said to my surprise that she hardly ever saw them nowadays. Other friends whom I mentioned elicited the same remark. I spoke to her then of the folly of shutting herself up and brooding, and especially of the silliness of cutting herself adrift from her friends. Then she came bursting out with the truth. "'It's not my doing, it's theirs. There's not a soul in the place who'll speak to me now. When I go down the High Street, they all get out of the way, so that they shan't have to meet me or speak to me. I'm a kind of leper. It's awful. I can't bear it any longer. I shall have to sell the house and go abroad. Yet why should I be driven away from home like this? I've done nothing." I was more disturbed than I can tell you. I was knitting a comforter for old Mrs. Hay at the time, and in my perturbation I dropped 2 stitches and never discovered it until long after. "'My dear Mabel,' I said, "'you amaze me. "'But what is the cause of all this?' "'Even as a child, Mabel was always difficult. "'I had the greatest difficulty in getting her to give me a straightforward answer to my question. "'She would only say vague things about wicked talk and idle people "'who had nothing better to do than gossip "'and people who put ideas into other people's heads. "'That is all quite clear to me,' I said. "'There is evidently some story being circulated about you. "'But what that story is, you must know as well as anyone. "'And you are going to tell me.' "'It's so wicked,' moaned Mabel. "'Of course it's wicked,' I said briskly. "'There's nothing that you can tell me about people's minds "'that would astonish or surprise me. "'Now, Mabel, will you tell me in plain English "'what people are saying about you?' "'Then it all came out.' It seemed that Geoffrey Denman's death, being quite sudden and unexpected, gave rise to various rumours. In fact, and in plain English, as I had put it to her, people were saying that she had poisoned her husband. Now, as I expect you know, there is nothing more cruel than talk, and there is nothing more difficult to combat. When people say things behind your back, there is nothing you can refute or deny. And the rumours go on growing and growing, and no one can stop them. I was quite certain of one thing. Mabel was quite incapable of poisoning anyone, and I didn't see why life should be ruined for her, and her home made unbearable just because, in all probability, she had been doing something silly and foolish. "'There is no smoke without fire,' I said. "'Now, Mabel, you've got to tell me what started people off on this tack. There must have been something.' Mabel was very incoherent, and declared there was nothing, nothing at all, except, of course, that Geoffrey's death had been very sudden. He had seemed quite well at supper that evening, and had taken violently ill in the night. The doctor had been sent for, but the poor man had died a few minutes after the doctor's arrival. Death had been thought to be the result of eating poisoned mushrooms. "'Well,' I said, "'I suppose a sudden death of that kind might start tongues wagging, "'but surely not without some additional facts. "'Did you have a quarrel with Geoffrey or anything of that kind?' "'She admitted that she had had a quarrel with him "'on the preceding morning at breakfast-time. "'And the servants heard it, I suppose,' I asked. "'They weren't in the room.' "'No, my dear,' I said, "'but they probably were fairly near the door outside.' I knew the carrying power of Mabel's high-pitched hysterical voice only too well. Geoffrey Denman, too, was a man given to raising his voice loudly when angry. "'What did you quarrel about?' I asked. Oh, the usual things. It was always the same things over and over again. Some little thing would start us off, and then Geoffrey became impossible and said abominable things, and I told him what I thought of him. There had been a lot of quarrelling then, I asked. It wasn't my fault. My dear child, I said, it doesn't matter whose fault it was. That is not what we are discussing. In a place like this, everybody's private affairs are more or less public property. You and your husband were always quarrelling. You had a particularly bad quarrel one morning, and that night your husband died suddenly and mysteriously. Is that all? Or is there anything else? I don't know what you mean by anything else, said Mabel sullenly. Just what I say, my dear. If you've done anything silly, don't, for heaven's sake, keep it back now. I only want to do what I can to help you. Nothing and nobody can help, said Mabel wildly, except death. Have a little more faith in Providence, dear, I said. Now then, Mabel, I know perfectly well there is something else you are keeping back. I always did know, even when she was a child, when she was not telling me the whole truth. It took a long time, but I got it out at last. She had gone down to the chemist's that morning and had bought some arsenic. She had had, of course, to sign the book for it. Naturally, the chemist had talked. "Who is your doctor?" I asked. "Dr. Rawlinson." I knew him by sight. Mabel had pointed him out to me the other day. To put it in perfectly plain language, he was what I would describe as an old dodderer. I've had too much experience of life to believe in the infallibility of doctors. Some of them are clever men, and some of them are not, and half the time the best of them don't know what is the matter with you. I have no truck with doctors and their medicines myself. I thought things over, and then I put my bonnet on and went to call on Dr. Rawlinson. He was just what I had thought him, a nice old man, kindly, vague, and so short-sighted as to be pitiful. Slightly deaf, and withal touchy and sensitive to the last degree. He was on his high horse at once when I mentioned Geoffrey Denman's death, talked for a long time about various kinds of fungi, edible and otherwise. He had questioned the cook, and she had admitted that one or two of the mushrooms cooked had been a little queer. But as the shop had sent them, she thought they must be all right. The more she thought about them since, the more she was convinced that their appearance was unusual. "She would be," I said. "They would start by being quite like mushrooms in appearance, and they would end by being orange with purple spots. There is nothing that class cannot remember if it tries." I gathered that Denman had been past speech when the doctor got to him. He was incapable of swallowing, and had died within a few minutes. The doctor seemed perfectly satisfied with the certificate he had given. But how much of that was obstinacy, and how much of it was genuine belief, I could not be sure. I went straight home, and I asked Mabel quite frankly why she had bought arsenic. "You must have had some idea in your mind," I pointed out. Mabel burst into tears. "I wanted to make away with myself," she moaned. "I was too unhappy. I thought I would end it all." "Have you the arsenic still?" I asked. "No, I threw it away." I sat there turning things over and over in my mind. "What happened when he was taken ill? Did he call you?" "No," she shook her head. "He rang the bell violently, and he must have rung several times. At last Dorothy, the house parlourmaid, heard it, and she waked the cook up, and they came down. When Dorothy saw him, she was frightened. He was rambling and delirious. She left the cook with him and came rushing to me. I got up and went to him. Of course, I saw at once he was dreadfully ill. Unfortunately, Brewster, who looks after old Mr. Denman, was away for the night, so there was no one who knew what to do. I sent Dorothy off for the doctor, and Cook and I stayed with him, but after a few minutes I couldn't bear it any longer. It was too dreadful. I ran away to my room and locked the door." "Very selfish and unkind of you," I said. "No doubt that conduct of yours has done nothing to help you since. You may be sure of that. Cook will have repeated it everywhere. Well, well, this is a bad business." Next I spoke to the servants. The cook wanted to tell me about the mushrooms, but I stopped her. I was tired of these mushrooms. Instead, I questioned both of them very closely about their master's condition on that night. They both agreed that he seemed to be in great agony, that he was unable to swallow, and he could only speak in a strangled voice, and When he did speak, it was only rambling, nothing sensible. "What did he say when he was rambling?" I asked curiously. "Something about fish, wasn't it?" turning to the other. Dorothy agreed. "A heap of fish," she said. "Some nonsense like that. I could see at once he wasn't in his right mind, poor gentleman." There didn't seem to be any sense to be made out of that. As a last resource, I went up to see Brewster, who was a gaunt, middle-aged woman of about 50. "It's a pity that I wasn't here that night," she said. "Nobody seems to have tried to do anything for him until the doctor came." "I suppose he was delirious," I said doubtfully, "but that is not a symptom of ptomaine poisoning, is it?" "Depends," said Brewster. I asked her how her patient was getting on. She shook her head. "It's pretty bad," she said. "Weak?" "Oh, no, no, he's strong enough physically. All but his eyesight, that's failing badly. May outlive all of us, but his mind's failing very fast now. I told both Mr. and Mrs. Denman that he ought to be in an institution, but Mrs. Denman wouldn't hear of it at any price." I will say for Mabel that she always had a kindly heart. Well, there the thing was. I thought it over in every aspect, and at last I decided there was only one thing to be done. In view of the rumours that were going about, permission must be sought to exhume the body, and a proper post-mortem must be made, and lying tongues quietened once and for all. Mabel, of course, made a fuss, mostly on sentimental grounds, disturbing the dead man in his peaceful grave, etc., etc., but I was firm. I won't make a long story of this part of it. We got the lauder, and they did the autopsy, or whatever they call it, but the result was not so satisfactory as it might have been. There was no trace of arsenic. That was all to the good. But the actual words of the report were that there was nothing to show by what means deceased had come to his death. So you see, that didn't lead us out of trouble altogether. People went on talking about rare poisons impossible to detect and rubbish of that sort. I'd seen the pathologist who had done the post-mortem, and I'd asked him several questions, though he tried his best to get out of answering most of them. But I got out of him that he considered it highly unlikely that the poisoned mushrooms were the cause of death. An idea was simmering in my mind, and I asked him what poison, if any, could have been employed to obtain that result. He made a long explanation to me, most of which I must admit I did not follow, but it amounted to this. The death might have been due to some strong vegetable alkaloid. The idea I had was this. Supposing the taint of insanity was in Geoffrey Denman's blood also, might he not have made away with himself? He had at one period of his life studied medicine, and he would have a good knowledge of poisons and their effects. I didn't think it sounded very likely, but it was the only thing I could think of, and I was nearly at my wit's end, I can tell you. Now, I dare say you modern young people will laugh, but when I am in really bad trouble, I always say a little prayer to myself. Anywhere, when I'm walking, along the street, or at a bazaar, and I always get an answer. It may be some trifling thing, apparently quite unconnected with the subject, but there it is. I had that text pinned over my bed when I was a little girl. Ask, and you shall receive. On the morning that I'm telling you about, I was walking along the high street, and I was praying hard. I shut my eyes, and when I opened them, what do you think was the first thing that I saw? 5 faces with various degrees of interest were turned to Miss Marple. It may be safely assumed, however, that no one would have guessed the answer to the question right. "I saw," said Miss Marple impressively, "the window of the fishmonger's shop. There was only one thing in it, a fresh haddock." She looked round triumphantly. "Oh, my God," said Raymond West, "an answer to a prayer, a fresh haddock." "Yes, Raymond," said Miss Marple severely, "and there's no need to be so profane about it. The hand of God is everywhere. The first thing I saw were the black spots, the marks of St. Peter's thumb, that is the legend, you know, St. Peter's thumb, and that brought things home to me. I needed faith, the ever-true faith of St. Peter. I connected the two things together, faith and fish. Sir Henry blew his nose rather hurriedly. Joyce bit her lip. Now, what did that bring to my mind? Of course, both the cook and the house parlourmaid mentioned fish as being one of the things spoken of by the dying man. I was convinced, absolutely convinced, that there was some solution of the mystery to be found in these words. I went home determined to get to the bottom of the matter. She paused. "Has it ever occurred to you," the old lady went on, "how much we go by what is called, I believe, the context? There's a place on Dartmoor called Grey Weathers. If you were talking to a farmer there and mentioned Grey Weathers, he would probably conclude that you were speaking of these stone circles. Yet it's possible that you might be speaking of the atmosphere. And in the same way, if you were meaning the stone circles, an outsider hearing a fragment of the conversation might think you meant the weather. So when we repeat a conversation, we don't, as a rule, repeat the actual words. We put in some other words that seem to us to mean exactly the same thing." I saw both the cook and Dorothy separately. I asked the cook if she was quite sure that her master had really mentioned a heap of fish. She said she was quite sure. "Were these his exact words?" I asked, "or did he mention some particular kind of fish?" "That's it," said the cook. "It was some particular kind of fish, but I can't remember what now. A heap of... now, what was it? Not any of the fish you sent to table. Would it be a perch, now, or pike? No, it didn't begin with a P." Dorothy also recalled that her master had mentioned some special kind of fish. "Some outlandish kind of fish it was," she said. "A pile of... Oh, now, what was it?" "Did he say heap or pile?" I asked. "I think he said pile, but there, I really can't be sure. It's so hard to remember the actual words, isn't it, miss, especially when they don't seem to make sense? Now I come to think of it, I'm pretty sure it was a pile, and the fish began with C. But it wasn't a cod or a crayfish." "The next part is where I really am proud of myself," said Miss Marple, "because, of course, I don't know anything about drugs. Nasty, dangerous things, I call them. I've got an old recipe of my grandmother's for tansy tea that is worth any amount of your drugs. But I knew that there were several medical volumes in the house, and in one of them there was an index of drugs. You see, my idea was that Geoffrey had taken some particular poison and was trying to say the name of it. Well, I looked down the list of H's, beginning H-E. Nothing there that sounded likely. Then I began on the P's, and almost at once I came to, what do you think?" She looked round, postponing her moment of triumph. "Pilocarpine. Can't you understand a man who could hardly speak, trying to drag that word out? What would that sound like to a cook who had never heard the word? Wouldn't it convey the impression, pile of carp?"
"By Jove," said Sir Henry.
"I should never have hit upon that," said Dr. Pender. "Most interesting," said Mr. Petherick, "really most interesting." I turned quickly to the page indicated in the index. I read about pilocarpine and its effect on the eyes and other things that didn't seem to have any bearing on the case, but at last I came to a most significant phrase. "Has been tried with success as an antidote for atropine poisoning." I can't tell you the light that dawned upon me then. I never had thought it likely that Geoffrey Denman would commit suicide. No, this new solution was not only possible, but I was absolutely sure it was the correct one, because all the pieces fitted in logically.
"I'm not going to try to guess," said Raymond. "Go on, Aunt Jane, and tell us what was so startlingly clear to you."
"I don't know anything about medicine, of course," said Miss Marple, "but I did happen to know this, that when my eyesight was failing, the doctor ordered me drops with atropine sulphate in them. I went straight upstairs to old Mr. Denman's room. I didn't beat about the bush. 'Mr. Denman,' I said, 'I know everything. Why did you poison your son?' He looked at me for a minute or two. Rather a handsome old man he was in his way, and then he burst out laughing. It was one of the most vicious laughs I've ever heard. I can assure you it made my flesh creep. I had only heard anything like it once before, when poor Mrs. Jones went off her head.
"Yes," he said, "I got even with Geoffrey. I was too clever for Geoffrey. Going to put me away, was he? Have me shut up in an asylum. I heard them talking about it. Mabel's a good girl. Mabel stuck up for me, but I knew she wouldn't be able to stand up against Geoffrey. In the end, he would have had his own way, always did, but I settled him. I settled my kind, loving son. Ha ha! I crept down in the night. It was quite easy. Brewster was away. My dear son was asleep. He had a glass of water by the side of his bed. He always woke up in the middle of the night and drank it off. I poured it away. Ha ha! And I emptied the bottle of eye drops into the glass. He would wake up and swill it down before he knew what it was. There was only a tablespoonful of it, quite enough, quite enough. And so he did. They came to me in the morning and broke it to me very gently. They were afraid it would upset me. Ha, 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 ha. Well, said Miss Marple, that's the end of the story. Of course, the poor old man was put in an asylum. He wasn't really responsible for what he'd done, and the truth was known, and everyone was sorry for Mabel, and could not do enough to make up to her for the unjust suspicions that Ed had. But if it hadn't been for Geoffrey realizing what the stuff was he had swallowed, and trying to get everybody to get hold of the antidote without delay, it might never have been found out. I believe there are very definite symptoms with atropine, dilated pupils of the eyes and all that, but of course, as I've said, Dr. Rawlinson was very short-sighted, poor old man. And in the same medical book which I went on reading, and some of it was most interesting, it gave the symptoms of ptomaine poisoning and atropine, and they are not unlike. But I can assure you, I've never seen a pile of fresh haddock without thinking of the thumb mark of St. Peter. There was a very long pause. "My dear friend," said Mr. Petherick, "my very dear friend, you really are amazing."
"I shall recommend Scotland Yard to come to you for advice," said Sir Henry.
"Well, at all events, Aunt Jane," said Raymond, "there's one thing that you don't know."
"Oh, yes, I do, dear," said Miss Marple. "It happened just before dinner, didn't it? When you took Joyce out to admire the sunset. It's a very favourite place, that. There by the jasmine hedge. That is where the milkman asked Annie if he could put up the bands."
"Dash it all, Aunt Jane," said Raymond. "Don't spoil all the romance. Joyce and I aren't like the milkman and Annie."
"That is where you make a mistake, dear," said Miss Marple. "Everybody is very much alike, really. But fortunately, perhaps, they don't realize it."
Death by Drowning. Sir Henry Clithering, ex-commissioner of Scotland Yard, was staying with his friend the Bantries at their place near the little village of St. Mary Mead. On Saturday morning, coming down to breakfast at the pleasant, guestly hour of 10:15, he almost collided with his hostess, Mrs. Bantry, in the doorway of the breakfast-room. She was rushing from the room, evidently in a condition of some excitement and distress. Colonel Bantry was sitting at the table, his face rather redder than usual. "Morning, Clithering," he said. "Nice day. Help yourself." Sir Henry obeyed. As he took his seat, a plate of kidneys and bacon in front of him, his host went on. "Dolly's a bit upset this morning."
"Yes, I rather thought so," said Sir Henry mildly.
He wondered a little. His hostess was of a placid disposition, little given to moods or excitements. As far as Sir Henry knew, she felt keenly on one subject only, gardening.
"Yes," said Colonel Bantry, "a bit of news we got this morning upset her. Girl in the village. Emmett's daughter. Emmett, who keeps the Blue Boar."
"Oh, yes, of course."
"Yes," said Colonel Bantry thoughtfully. "Pretty girl. Got herself into trouble. Usual story. I've been arguing with Dolly about that. Foolish of me. Women never see sense. Dolly was all up in arms for the girl. You know what women are. Men are brutes, all the rest of it, etc. But it's not so simple as all that, not in these days. Girls know what they're about. Fellow who seduces a girl is not necessarily a villain. 50-50 as often as not. I rather liked young Sanford myself, a young ass, rather than a Don Juan, I should have said. Is it this man Sanford who has got the girl into trouble?"
"So it seems, of course. I don't know anything personally," said the Colonel cautiously. "It's all gossip and chat. You know what this place is. As I say, I know nothing, and I'm not like Dolly, leaping to conclusions, flinging accusations all over the place. Damn it all, one ought to be careful in what one says. You know, inquest and all that.
Inquest?
Colonel Bantry stared.
Yes, didn't I tell you? Girl drowned herself. That's what all the pother's about.
That's a nasty business, said Sir Henry.
Of course it is. Don't like to think of it myself. Poor pretty little devil. Her father's a hard man, by all accounts. I suppose she just felt she couldn't face the music.
He paused.
That's what upset Dolly so.
Where did she drown herself?
In the river, just below the mill. It runs pretty fast. There's a footpath and a bridge across. They think she threw herself off that. Oh, well, well. Doesn't bear thinking about.
And with a portentous rustle, Colonel Bantry opened his newspaper and proceeded to distract his mind from painful matters by an absorption in the newest iniquities of the government.
Sir Henry was only mildly interested by the village tragedy. After breakfast he established himself on a comfortable chair on the lawn, tilted his hat over his eyes, and contemplated life from a peaceful angle. It was about 11:30 when a neat parlourmaid tripped across the lawn.
"If you please, sir, Miss Marple has called and would like to see you."
"Miss Marple?" Sir Henry sat up and straightened his hat. The name surprised him. He remembered Miss Marple very well, her gentle, quiet, old maidish ways, her amazing penetration. He remembered a dozen unsolved and hypothetical cases, and how in each case this typical old maid of the village had leapt unerringly to the right solution of the mystery. Sir Henry had a very deep respect for Miss Marple. He wondered what had brought her to see him. Miss Marple was sitting in the drawing-room, very upright as always, a gaily coloured marketing basket of foreign extraction beside her. Her cheeks were rather pink, and she seemed flustered.
"Oh, Sir Henry, I'm so glad, so fortunate to find you. I just happened to hear that you were staying down here. I do hope that you'll forgive me."
"This is a great pleasure," said Sir Henry, taking her hand. "I'm afraid Mrs. Bantry's out."
"Yes," said Miss Marple. "I saw her talking to Footit, the butcher, as I passed. Henry Footit was run over yesterday. That was his dog. One of those smooth-haired fox terriers, rather stout and quarrelsome, that butchers always seem to have."
"Yes," said Sir Henry helpfully.
"I was glad to get her when she wasn't at home," continued Miss Marple, "because it was you I wanted to see about this sad affair."
"Henry Footit?" asked Sir Henry, slightly bewildered. Miss Marple threw him a reproachful glance.
"No, no. Rose Emmett, of course. You've heard?"
Sir Henry nodded. "Bantry was telling me. Very sad."
He was a little puzzled. He couldn't conceive why Miss Marple should want to see him about Rose Emmett.
Miss Marple sat down again. Sir Henry also sat. When the old lady spoke, her manner had changed. It was grave and had a certain dignity.
"You may remember, Sir Henry, that on one or two occasions we played what was really a pleasant kind of game, propounding the mysteries and giving solutions. You were kind enough to say that that I didn't do too badly."
"You beat us all," said Sir Henry warmly. "You displayed an absolute genius for getting to the truth. And you always instanced, I remember, some village parallel which had supplied you with the clue."
He smiled as he spoke, but Miss Marple did not smile. She remained very grave.
"What you have said has emboldened me to come to you now. I feel that if I say something to you, at least you will not laugh at me."
He realized suddenly that she was in deadly earnest.
"Certainly. I won't laugh," he said gently.
"Sir Henry, this girl, Rose Emmett, she did not drown herself. She was murdered, and I know who murdered her." Sir Henry was silent with sheer astonishment for quite 3 seconds. Miss Marple's voice had been perfectly quiet and unexcited. She might have been making the most ordinary statement in the world for all the emotion she showed.
"That is a very serious statement to make, Miss Marple," said Sir Henry, when he had recovered his breath.
She nodded her head gently several times.
"I know, I know. That is why I have come to you."
"But, my dear lady, I am not the person to come to.
I'm merely a private individual nowadays. If you have knowledge of the kind you claim, you must go to the police.
I don't think I can do that, said Miss Marple.
Why not?
Because, you see, I haven't got any, what you call, knowledge.
You mean it's only a guess on your part?
You can call it that if you like, but it's not really that at all. I know. I'm in a position to know, but if I gave my reasons for knowing to Inspector Druitt, well, he'd simply laugh, and really, I don't know that I'd blame him. It's very difficult to understand what you might call specialized knowledge.
Such as, suggested Sir Henry.
Miss Marple smiled a little. If I were to tell you that I know because of a man called Peasgood leaving turnips instead of carrots when he came round with a cart and sold vegetables to my niece several years ago.
She stopped eloquently. A very appropriate name for the trade, murmured Sir Henry. You mean that you are simply judging from the facts in a parallel case?
I know human nature, said Miss Marple. It's impossible not to know human nature living in a village all these years. The question is, do you believe me, or don't you? She looked at him very straight. The pink flush had heightened on her cheeks. Her eyes met his steadily without wavering. Sir Henry was a man with a very vast experience of life. He made his decisions quickly without beating about the bush. Unlikely and fantastic as Miss Marple's statement might seem, he was instantly aware that he accepted it.
I do believe you, Miss Marple, but I do not see what you want me to do in the matter, or why you've come to me.
I have thought and thought about it, said Miss Marple. As I said, it would be useless going to the police without any facts. I have no facts. What I would ask you to do is to interest yourself in the matter. Inspector Druitt would be most flattered, I'm sure, and of course, if the matter went farther, Colonel Melchett, the chief constable, I'm sure, would be wax in your hands.
She looked at him appealingly. What data are you going to give me to work upon?
I thought, said Miss Marple, of writing a name, the name, on a piece of paper and giving it to you. Then, if on investigation you decide that the person is not involved in any way, well, I shall have been quite wrong. She paused, and then added with a slight shiver, Oh, it would be so dreadful, so very dreadful, if an innocent person were to be hanged.
What on earth? Cried Sir Henry, startled.
She turned a distressed face upon him. I may be wrong about that, though I don't think so. Inspector Druitt, you see, is really an intelligent man, but a mediocre amount of intelligence is sometimes most dangerous. Doesn't take one far enough.
Sir Henry looked at her curiously.
Fumbling a little, Miss Marple opened a small reticule. She took out a little notebook, tore out a leaf, carefully wrote a name on it, and folding it in two, handed it to Sir Henry. He opened it and read the name. It conveyed nothing to him, but his eyebrows lifted a little. He looked across at Miss Marple and tucked the piece of paper in his pocket.
Well, well, he said, rather an extraordinary business, this. I've never done anything like it before. But I'm going to back my judgment of you, Miss Marple.
Sir Henry was sitting in a room with Colonel Melchett, the chief constable of the county, and Inspector Druitt. The chief constable was a little man of aggressively military demeanour. The inspector was big and broad and eminently sensible.
I really do feel I'm butting in, said Sir Henry with a pleasant smile. I can't really tell you why I'm doing it.
Strict truth, this.
My dear fellow, we're charmed. It's a great compliment.
Honoured, Sir Henry, said the inspector. The chief constable was thinking, bored to death, poor old fellow at the Bantries. The old man abusing the government and the old woman babbling on about bulbs.
The inspector was thinking, pity we're not up against a real teaser. One of the best brains in England, I've heard it said. Pity it's all such plain sailing.
Aloud, the chief constable said,
I'm afraid it's all very sordid and straightforward. First idea was that the girl had pitched herself in. She was in the family way, you understand. However, our doctor, Haydock, is a careful fellow. He noticed the bruises on each arm, upper arm, caused before death, just where a fellow would have taken her by the arms and flung her in.
Would that require much strength? I think not. There'd be no struggle. The girl would be taken unawares. It's a footbridge of slippery wood, easiest thing in the world to pitch her over. There's no handrail on that side. You know for a fact that the tragedy occurred there? Yes, we've got a boy, Jimmy Brown, aged 12. He was in the woods on the other side. He heard a kind of scream from the bridge and a splash. It was dusk, you know, difficult to see anything. Presently he saw something white floating down in the water, and he ran and got help. They got her out, but it was too late to revive her. Sir Henry nodded. The boy saw no one on the bridge? No, but as I tell you, it was dusk, and there's a mist always hanging about there. I'm going to question him as to whether he saw anyone about just afterwards or just before. You see, he naturally assumed that the girl had thrown herself over. Everybody did to start with. Still, we've got the note, said Inspector Druitt. He turned to Sir Henry. Note in the dead girl's pocket, sir, written with a kind of artist pencil it was. And all of a sop there the paper was, we managed to read it. And what did it say? It was from young Sanford. All right, that's how it ran. I'll meet you at the bridge at 8:30, R.S. Well, it was as near as might be to 8:30, a few minutes after, when Jimmy Brown heard the cry and the splash. I don't know whether you've met Sanford at all, went on Colonel Melchett. He's been down here about a month, one of those modern-day young architects who build peculiar houses, doing a house for Allington. God knows what it's going to be like. Full of new-fangled stuff, I suppose, glass dinner table and surgical chairs made of steel and webbing. Well, that's neither here nor there, but it shows the kind of chap Sanford is. Bolshy, you know, no morals. Seduction, said Sir Henry mildly, is quite an old, established crime, though it does not, of course, date back so far as murder. Colonel Melchett stared. Oh, yes, he said, quite, quite. Well, Sir Henry, said Druitt, there it is. An ugly business, but plain. This young Sanford gets the girl into trouble, then he's all for clearing off back to London. He's got a girl there, a nice young lady, he's engaged to be married to her. Well, naturally, this business, if she gets to hear of it, may cook his goose good and proper. He meets Rose at the bridge, missed the evening, no one about. He catches her by the shoulders and pitches her in. Proper young swine, and deserves what's coming to him, that's my opinion. Sir Henry was silent for a minute or two. He perceived a strong undercurrent of local prejudice. The new-fangled architect was not likely to be popular in the conservative village of St. Mary Mead. There's no doubt, I suppose, that this man Sanford was actually the father of the coming child, he asked. He's the father, all right, said Druitt. Rose Emmett let out as much to her father. She thought he'd marry her. Marry her, not he. Yeah, me, thought Sir Henry, I seem to be back in mid-Victorian melodrama. Unsuspecting girl, the villain from London, the stern father, the betrayal. We only need the faithful village lover. Yes, I think it's time I asked about him. And aloud he said, hadn't the girl a young man of her own down here? You mean Joe Ellis, said the inspector. Good fellow, Joe. Carpentering's his trade. Ah, she's stuck to Joe. Colonel Melchett nodded approval. Stick to your own class, he snapped. How did Joe Ellis take this affair, asked Sir Henry. Nobody knew how he was taking it, said the inspector. He's a quiet fellow, is Joe. Close. Anything Rose did was right in his eyes. She had him on her string all right. Just hoped she'd come back to him some day. That was his attitude, I reckon. I'd like to see him, said Sir Henry. Oh, we're going to look him up, said Colonel Melchett. We're not neglecting any line. I thought myself we'd see Emmett first, then Sanford. And then we can go on and see Ellis. That suit you, Clithering? Sir Henry said it would suit him admirably. They found Tom Emmett at the Blue Boar. He was a big, burly man of middle age, with a shifty eye and truculent jaw. Glad to see you, gentlemen. Good morning, Colonel. Come in here, we'll be private. Can I offer you anything, gentlemen? No? It's as you please. You've come about this business of my poor girl. Ah, she was a good girl, Rose was. Always was a good girl. Well, this bloody swine, beg pardon, but that's what he is, till he came along. Promised her marriage, he did. But I'll have the law of him. Drove her to it, he did, murdering swine, bringing disgrace on all of us. My poor girl. Your daughter distinctly told you that Mr. Stanford was responsible for her condition? Asked Melchett crisply. She did, in his very room she did. And what did you say to her? Asked Sir Henry. Say to her? The man seemed momentarily taken aback. Yes, you didn't, for example, threaten to turn her out of the house. I was a bit upset. That's only natural. I'm sure you'll agree that's only natural, but of course I didn't turn her out of the house. I wouldn't do such a thing. He assumed virtuous indignation. No! What's the law for? That's what I say. What's the law for? He got to do the right thing by her, and if he didn't, by God, he's got to pay. He brought down his fist on the table. What time did you last see your daughter? Asked Melchett. Yesterday, tea time. What was her manner then? Well, much as usual, I didn't notice anything. If I'd known... But you didn't know, said the inspector dryly. They took their leave. Emmett hardly creates a favourable impression, said Sir Henry thoughtfully. Bit of a blackguard, said Melchett. He'd have bled Stanford all right if he'd had the chance. Their next call was on the architect. Rex Sanford was very unlike the picture Sir Henry had unconsciously formed of him. He was a tall young man, very fair and very thin. His eyes were blue and dreamy, his hair was untidy and rather too long. His speech was a little too ladylike. Colonel Melchett introduced himself and his companions. Then, passing straight to the object of his visit, he invited the architect to make a statement as to his movements on the previous evening. "You understand," he said warningly, "I have no power to compel a statement from you, and any statement you make may be used in evidence against you. I want the position to be quite clear to you."
I don't understand," said Sanford.
"You understand that the girl Rose Emmett was drowned last night?"
"I know. Oh, it's too distressing, really. I haven't slept a wink. I've been incapable of any work today. I feel responsible, terribly responsible." He ran his hands through his hair, making it untidier still. "I never meant any harm," he said piteously. "I never thought, I never dreamt she'd take it in that way."
He sat down at the table and buried his face in his hands. "Do I understand you to say, Mr. Sanford, that you refused to make a statement as to where you were last night at 8:30?
"No, no, no, certainly not. I was out. I went for a walk."
"You went to meet Miss Emmett?"
"No, I went by myself through the woods, a long way."
"Then how do you account for this note, sir, which was found in the dead girl's pocket?" And Inspector Druitt read it aloud, without emotion. "Now, sir," he finished, "you deny that you wrote that?"
No, you're right, I did write it. Rose asked me to meet her. She insisted. I didn't know what to do, so I wrote that note."
"Ah, that's better," said the inspector.
"But I didn't go." Sanford's voice rose high and excited. "I didn't go. I felt it would be much better not. I was returning to town tomorrow. I felt it would be much better not to meet. I intended to write from London and make some arrangement."
"You're aware, sir, that this girl was going to have a child and that she had named you as its father?" Sanford groaned, but didn't answer. "Was that statement true, sir?" Sanford buried his face deeper.
"I suppose so," he said in a muffled voice.
"Ah," Inspector Druitt could not disguise his satisfaction. "Now, about this walk of yours, is there anyone who saw you last night?"
"I don't know. I don't think so. As far as I can remember, I didn't meet anybody."
"That's a pity."
"What do you mean?" Sanford stared wildly at him. "What does it matter whether I was out for a walk or not? What difference does that make to Rose drowning herself?"
"Ah," said the inspector, "but you see, she didn't. She was thrown in deliberately, Mr. Sanford."
"She was..." It took him a minute or two to take in all the horror of it. "My God!" Then he dropped into a chair. Colonel Melchett made a move to depart.
"You understand, Sanford," he said. "You're on no account to leave this house." The three men left together. The inspector and the chief constable exchanged glances.
"That's enough, I think, sir," said the inspector.
"Yes, get a warrant made out and arrest him." "Excuse me," said Sir Henry, "I've forgotten my gloves." He re-entered the house rapidly. Sanford was sitting just as they left him, staring dazedly in front of him. "I have come back," said Sir Henry, "to tell you that I, personally, am anxious to do all I can to assist you. The motive of my interest in you I am not at liberty to reveal, but I am going to ask you, if you will, to tell me as briefly as possible exactly what passed between you and this girl Rose."
She was very pretty," said Sanford, "very pretty and very alluring, and she made a dead set for me. Oh, before God, that's true. She wouldn't let me alone. And it was lonely down here, and nobody liked me much, and as I say, she was amazingly pretty, and she seemed to know her way about, and all that." His voice died away. He looked up. "And then this happened. She wanted me to marry her. I didn't know what to do. I'm engaged to a girl in London. Oh, she ever gets to hear of this, and she will, of course. Well, it's all up. She won't understand. How could she? And I am a rotter, of course. As I say, I didn't know what to do. I avoided seeing Rose again. I thought I'd get back to town, see my lawyer, make arrangements about money and so forth for her. Oh, God, what a fool I've been. And it's all so clear, the case against me. But they've made a mistake. She must have done it herself."
"Did she ever threaten to take her life?" Sanford shook his head.
"Never. I shouldn't have said she was that sort."
"What about a man called Joe Ellis?"
"A carpenter fellow, good old village stock. Dull fellow, but crazy about Rose."
"He might have been jealous," suggested Sir Henry.
"I suppose he was a bit, but he's a bovine kind. He'd suffer in silence."
"Well," said Sir Henry, "I must be going." He rejoined the others. "You know, Melchett," he said, "I feel we ought to have a look at this other fellow, Ellis, before we do anything drastic. Pity if you made an arrest that turned out to be a mistake. After all, jealousy is a pretty good motive for murder. Pretty common one, too." "That's true enough," said the inspector, "but Joe Ellis isn't that kind. Wouldn't hurt a fly. Why, nobody's ever seen him out of temper. Still, I agree we'd better just ask him where he was last night. He'll be at home now. He lodges with Mrs. Bartlett, very decent soul, a widow, takes in a bit of washing." The little cottage to which they bent their footsteps was spotlessly clean and neat. A big, stout woman of middle age opened the door to them. She had a pleasant face and blue eyes. "Good morning, Mrs. Bartlett," said the inspector. "Is Joe Ellis here?" "Came back not 10 minutes ago," said Mrs. Bartlett. "Step inside, will you please, sirs?" Wiping her hands on her apron, she led them into a tiny front parlour with stuffed birds, china dogs, a sofa, and several useless pieces of furniture. She hurriedly arranged seats for them, picked up a what-not bodily to make further room, and went out calling, "Joe, there's three gentlemen want to see you." A voice from the back kitchen replied, "I'll be there when I've cleaned myself." Mrs. Bartlett smiled. "Come in, Mrs. Bartlett," said Colonel Milchief. "Sit down." "Oh, no, sir, I couldn't think of it." Mrs. Bartlett was shocked at the idea. "You find Joe Ellis a good lodger?" inquired Milchett in a seemingly careless tone. "Couldn't have a better, sir. Real steady young fellow, never touches a drop of drink, takes a pride in his work, and always kind and helpful about the house. He put up those shelves for me, and he's fixed a new dresser in the kitchen. And any little thing that wants doing in the house, why, Joe does it as a matter of course, and won't hardly take thanks for it. Ah, there aren't many young fellows like Joe, sir." "Some girl'll be luckier some day," said Milchett carelessly. "He was rather sweet on that poor girl Rose Emmett, wasn't he?" Mrs. Bartlett sighed. "Made me tired, it did, him worshipping the ground she trod on and her not caring a snap of the fingers for him." "Where does Joe spend his evenings, Mrs. Bartlett?" "Here, sir, usually. Does some odd piece of work in the evening sometimes, and he's trying to learn bookkeeping by correspondence." "Ah, really? Was he in yesterday evening?" "Yes, sir." "You're sure, Mrs. Bartlett," said Sir Henry sharply.
She turned to him. "Quite sure, sir."
"He didn't go out, for instance, somewhere about 8 to 8:30.
"Oh, no," Mrs. Barty laughed. "He was fixing the kitchen dresser for me nearly all the evening, and I was helping him."
Sir Henry looked at her smiling, assured face, and felt his first pang of doubt. A moment later, Ellis himself entered the room. He was a tall, broad-shouldered young man, very good-looking in a rustic way. He had shy blue eyes and a good-tempered smile. Altogether an amiable young giant. Milchett opened the conversation. Mrs. Bartlett withdrew to the kitchen. "We're investigating the death of Rose Emmett. You knew her, Ellis?" "Yes," he hesitated and then muttered. "Hope to marry her one day, poor lass." "You've heard what her condition was?" "Yes." A spark of anger showed in his eye. "Let her down, he did, but to her for the best. She wouldn't have been happy married to him. I reckon she'd come to me when this happened. I'd have looked after her. In spite of... 'twant her fault, he led her astray with fine promises and all. Oh, she told me all about it. She'd no call to drown herself. It weren't worth it. Where were you, Ellis, last night at 8:30? Was it Sir Henry's fancy, or was there really a shade of constraint in the ready, almost too ready, reply? "I was here, fixing up a contraption in the kitchen for Mrs. B. You ask her, she'll tell you." He was too quick with that, thought Sir Henry. He's a slow-thinking man. That popped out so pat. I suspect he'd got it ready beforehand. Then he told himself that it was imagination. He was imagining things. Yes, even imagining an apprehensive glint in those blue eyes. A few more questions and answers, and they left. Sir Henry made an excuse to go to the kitchen. Mrs. Bartlett was busy at the stove. She looked up with a pleasant smile. A new dresser was fixed against the wall. It was not quite finished. Some tools lay about and some pieces of wood. "That's what Ellis was at work on last night," said Sir Henry. "Yes, sir. Nice bit of work, isn't it? He's a very clever carpenter, Joe is." No apprehensive gleam in her eye, no embarrassment. But Ellis, had he imagined it? No, there had been something. "I must tackle him," thought Sir Henry. Turning to leave the kitchen, he collided with a perambulator. "Not woken the baby up, I hope," he said. Mrs. Bartlett's laugh rang out. "Oh, no, sir! I've no children, more's the pity. That's what I take the laundry on, sir." "Oh, I see." He paused and said on an impulse, "Mrs. Bartlett, you knew Rose Emmett. Tell me what you really thought of her." She looked at him curiously. "Well, sir, I thought she was flighty. But she's dead, and I don't like to speak ill of the dead. But I have a reason, a very good reason for asking." He spoke persuasively. She seemed to consider, studying him attentively. Finally, she made up her mind. "It was a bad lot, sir," she said quietly. "I wouldn't say so before Joe. She took him in good and proper. That kind can. More's a pity. You know how it is, sir." Yes, Sir Henry knew. The Joe Ellises of the world were peculiarly vulnerable. They trusted blindly. But for that very cause, the shock of discovery might be greater. He left the cottage baffled and perplexed. He was up against a blank wall. Joe Ellis had been working indoors all yesterday evening. Mrs. Bartlett had actually been there watching him. Could one possibly get round that? There was nothing to set against it, except possibly that suspicious readiness in replying on Joe Ellis's part, that suggestion of having a story, pat. "Well," said Milchett, "that seems to make the matter quite clear, eh?" "Does, sir," agreed the inspector. "Sanford's our man, not a leg to stand upon. Things as plain as daylight. My opinion is the girl and her father were out to, well, practically blackmail him. He's no money to speak of. He didn't want the matter to get to his young lady's ears. He was desperate, and he acted accordingly. What do you say, sir?" he added, addressing Sir Henry deferentially. "Seems so," admitted Sir Henry, "and yet I can hardly picture Sanford committing any violent action." But he knew as he spoke that the objection was hardly valid. The meekest animal, when cornered, is capable of amazing actions.
"I should like to see the boy, though," he said suddenly, "the one who heard the cry." Jimmy Brown proved to be an intelligent lad, rather small for his age, with a sharp, rather cunning face. He was eager to be questioned, and was rather disappointed when checked in his dramatic tale of what he had heard on the fatal night. "You were on the other side of the bridge, I understand," said Sir Henry, "across the river from the village. Did you see anyone on that side as you came up over the bridge?"
"There was someone walking up in the woods, Mr. Sanford, I think it was, the architect gentleman who's building the queer house."
The three men exchanged glances.
"That was about 10 minutes or so before you heard the cry."
The boy nodded.
"Did you see anyone else on the village side of the river?"
"A man came along the path that side, going slow, and whistling he was. Might have been Joe Ellis."
"You couldn't possibly have seen who it was," said the inspector sharply, "what with the mist and its being dusk."
"It's on account of the whistle," said the boy. "Joe Ellis always whistles the same tune. I want to be happy. The only tune he knows."
He spoke with the scorn of the modernist for the old-fashioned.
"Anyone might whistle a tune," said Melchett. "Was he going towards the bridge?"
"No, other way, to village."
"I don't think we need concern ourselves with this unknown man," said Melchett. "You heard the cry and the splash, and a few minutes later you saw the body floating downstream, and you ran for help, going back to the bridge, crossing it, and making straight for the village. You didn't see anyone near the bridge as you ran for help?"
"I think as there were two men with a wheelbarrow on the river path, but they were some ways away, and I couldn't tell if they were coming or going, and Mr. Giles' place was nearest, so I ran there."
"You did well, my boy," said Melchett. "You acted very creditably and with presence of mind. You're a scout, aren't you?"
"Yes, sir."
"Very good, very good indeed."
Sir Henry was silent, thinking.
He took a slip of paper from his pocket, looked at it, shook his head. It didn't seem possible. And yet...
He decided to pay a call on Miss Marple. She received him in her pretty, slightly overcrowded old-style drawing-room.
"I've come to report progress," said Sir Henry. "I'm afraid that from our point of view things aren't going well. They're going to arrest Sanford, and I must say I think they're justified."
"You found nothing in... what shall I say? Support of my theory, then?" She looked perplexed, anxious. "Perhaps I've been wrong, quite wrong. You have such a wide experience. You would surely detect if it were so."
"For one thing," said Sir Henry, "I can hardly believe it. And for another, we're up against an unbreakable alibi. Joe Ellis was fixing shelves in the kitchen all the evening, and Mrs. Bartlett was watching him do it."
Miss Marple leant forward, taking in a quick breath. "Oh, but that can't be so," she said. "It was Friday night."
"Friday night?"
"Yes, Friday night. On Friday evenings, Mrs. Bartlett takes the laundry she has done round to the different people."
Sir Henry leant back in his chair. He remembered the boy Jimmy's story of the whistling man, and, yes, it would all fit in. He rose, taking Miss Marple warmly by the hand.
"I think I see my way," he said. "Least I can try."
5 minutes later he was back at Mrs. Bartlett's cottage and facing Joe Ellis in the little parlour among the china dogs.
"You lied to us, Ellis, about last night," he said crisply. "You were not in the kitchen here fixing the dresser between 8 and 8:30. You were seen walking along the path by the river towards the bridge a few minutes before Rose Emmett was murdered."
The man gasped.
"She weren't murdered. She weren't. I ought to do with it. She threw herself in. She did. She was desperate-like. I wouldn't have harmed her hair and her head. I wouldn't."
"Then why did you lie as to where you were?" asked Sir Henry keenly. The man's eyes shifted and lowered uncomfortably.
"I was scared. Mrs. B. saw me around there, and when we heard just afterwards what had happened, well, she thought it might look bad for me. I fixed I'd say I was working here, and she agreed to back me up. She's a rare one, she is. She's always been good to me."
Without a word, Sir Henry left the room and walked into the kitchen. Mrs. Bartlett was washing up at the sink.
"Mrs. Bartlett," he said, "I know everything. I think you'd better confess. That is, unless you want Joe Ellis hanged for something he didn't do."
"No, I see you don't want that. I'll tell you what happened.
You were out taking the laundry home. You came across Rose Emmett. You thought she'd given Joe the chuck and was taking up with this stranger. Now she was in trouble. Joe was prepared to come to the rescue, marry her if need be, and if she'd have him. He's lived in your house for 4 years. You've fallen in love with him. You want him for yourself. You hated this girl. You couldn't bear that this worthless little slut should take your man from you. You're a strong woman, Mrs. Bartlett. You caught the girl by the shoulders and shoved her over into the stream. A few minutes later, you met Joe Ellis. The boy Jimmy saw you together in the distance. But in the darkness and the mist, he assumed the perambulator was a wheelbarrow and two men wheeling it. You persuaded Joe that he might be suspected, and you concocted what was supposed to be an alibi for him, but which was really an alibi for you. Now then, I'm right, am I not? He held his breath. He'd staked all on this throw. She stood before him, rubbing her hands on her apron, slowly making up her mind. It's just as you say, sir, she said at last, in her quiet, subdued voice. A dangerous voice, Sir Henry suddenly felt it to be. I don't know what came over me. Shameless. That's what she was. It just came over me. She shan't take Joe from me. I haven't had a happy life, sir. My husband, he was a poor lot. An invalid and cross-grained. I nursed and looked after him, true. And then Joe came here to lodge. I'm not such an old woman, sir, in spite of my grey hair. I'm just 40, sir. Joe's 1 in 1,000. I'd have done anything for him, anything at all. He was like a little child, sir, so gentle and so believing. He was mine, sir, to look after and see to, and this... She swallowed, checked her emotion. Even at this moment she was a strong woman. She stood up straight and looked at Sir Henry curiously. I'm ready to come, sir. I never thought anyone would find out. I don't know how you knew, sir. I don't, I'm sure. Sir Henry shook his head gently. It was not I who knew, he said. And he thought of the piece of paper still reposing in his pocket, with the words on it written in neat old-fashioned handwriting. Mrs. Bartlett, with whom Joe Ellis lodges, at 2 Mill Cottages. Miss Marple had been right again.